Thanks for joining us this morning. Before we actually start the show, my guest today is John Lovett. We have Sergeant Tony Kelly from the Pima County Sheriff's Department on the phone. Tony, what announcement do you have to make?
Well, good morning, Sheriff. I'm looking forward to the show. I just wanted to remind folks out there that the Sheriff's Department process, we are running processes right now for deputies, corrections officers, even a psychologist. There's about 10 fields that we have open right now. With everything that's going on with the coronavirus or the COVID-19, we are still going through all of our processes. So I just wanted to let everybody know, if you see a job there, we are open and hiring, so don't think we're going to stop because of what's going on.
Actually, you need more people, don't you?
Well, we are meeting our goals and our missions. We just want to make sure that we don't let this hiccup in time create a problem down the road. So we wanted to let the community know, if you're looking for a good job, we have 10 different fields that are open right now.
Very cool. Okay. I appreciate you calling in.
Thank you for letting me say that.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So our guest today is John Lovett from TPD, Counter Narcotics. And what do you think about what's going on right now? It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of unprecedented in our lifetime. I mean, I go back to 9/11 and I think about how that sort of shook us for a year or two. And I expect the same will happen this time. But this is a little different than 9/11 was. It's really hard to find like an enemy to blame. And I think people are having a hard time processing how this is so random and potentially so lethal. And it really, really is scary for a lot of people.
I heard that the Democrats started it. Somebody told me the Democrats started it.
Yeah, so that's what I mean. I mean, it's demonization of whoever, of someone besides your group. And I think that's going around everywhere. I don't think anyone is locked up that kind of nasty behavior. But I do think this. I mean, we have an opportunity to pull together for the first time since 9/11 in a way that would be really beneficial for all of us. And I've seen some of that starting, and I'd like to see that continue. And we can come out of this stronger for whatever threats face us in the future.
Didn't it start in China?
Well, you know, so I've sort of studied since about 2004, there was a book came out called Influenza about the flu of 1918. I read that book, and I remember it sort of changed my whole outlook on pandemic flu at the time. And I've been believing that we would likely experience one of those again in my lifetime based on what I read at the time and the reading I've done since then. So, you know, a lot of stuff starts in various parts of the world, but particularly those kinds of things, a lot of them have emanated ultimately from China, although people didn't really realize that back in 1918, and it took finally completing the genome for the Spanish flu, which is what they did, finally from unearthing bodies and that were buried in the permafrost and figuring it all out, that there's a lot of any of these diseases. I guess they could start anywhere, but they do get around the world very quickly now.
And we've lived through other horrific situations. I'm sure we're going to survive this too.
Well, I'm sure we will. And hopefully, again, we'll take away some lessons to make us more prepared the next time. I mean, certainly our approach this time is better than it was in 1918, as we would all expect. But there's definitely some areas where we're hard-headed, and it's hard for us to learn as we go through these challenges.
What about the run on stores? I walked in the store the other day and I couldn't believe the shelves were empty.
Yes, that's really one of the things that is disappointing. And what I mean by disappointing is, okay, so they're running on stores because they don't have what they think they need at home. This is something we experienced when we were planning for Y2K back in the 90s.
I remember everyone, I had a party.
Just because it turned out to be a nothing, know that... people, I went and did 50 forums on that for the police department in the city of Tucson at the time, and people were genuinely scared. And you could see in their eyes this look that they had not prepared adequately to be able to take care of their family if something terrible had happened. And I saw that fear, and I watched the really illogical, irrational decision-making that people engaged in because of that fear. And guess what? You know, 2 weeks ago at Costco, I saw the same thing. And it's, I remember maybe it was a month ago, actually, I was there, and I remember coming home and saying, hey, you know, it was really bizarre today. People were nasty at Costco. And I was like, I wonder what that's all about. And, you know, I think it's what I call, you know, when I've talked about this over the years, lower brainstem. So you have this idea that you need to protect yourself and the people that are close to you. And suddenly all the socialization we've gone through in thousands of years goes out the window. And so that comes from, in my view, that comes from a lack of general preparedness. We did a whole series of public service announcements in the 90s in preparation for Y2K that were what we called all hazard. I mean, the idea was we, many people that were on the inside of the preparation for that knew that we weren't going to have the kind of disasters that were being predicted. But we did acknowledge that the lack of preparedness for Americans for being able to take care of themselves for 3 days or 30 days was really, really bad. And so we thought that it was an opportunity to spread the good word about why you ought to be able to take care of yourself for a longer period of time than a day or two. And then when Katrina hit later, we saw these people that were going like, I can't believe the federal government's not here to help. Well, we all knew and we still know and still are not prepared today to be able to take care of ourselves as a country for short periods of time, let alone longer periods of time. So that's a genuine disappointment. And it's, again, it's not because people are going to starve to death. Most people carry 30 days worth of food on their body. I mean, just in fat, right?
True.
I mean, I jokingly say that, but many Americans could last a very long time without those kinds of things. But just the fear associated with lack of access to essentials, again, creates these really bad decisions. We saw them in Katrina. We actually saw some of them around Y2K. And I think we're going to see some of them as we move forward. The hoarding of the N95 masks, it's just remarkable. And it's that kind of behavior can be prevented if people follow the basic Red Cross guidelines for preparedness, disaster preparedness for their homes. And guess what? It's not wasted. I mean, that kind of preparation is not wasted if you do it right. We were talking before the show about some of the cultural things in Wuhan, China that have really helped folks there. I was listening to a radio interview of some people during their lockdown, and they asked this old man, are you really worried about not being able to get your essentials? And he went into great detail explaining that he had only 6 months of food that had been saved, only 6 months of food. And so I, again, I read about that. I looked into it. And it's true. There's a, you know, cultural value to preparedness for food insecurity in countries that have gone through great famines. But, you know, in America, you can get up in the morning and go to a fast food place and get breakfast. Or you can, I mean, we're instant everything.
Right.
You know, in some ways, too, you know, I wouldn't say this is across the board, but there are people who are the lower end of the economic spectrum who do a better job preparing for things like this than people that have more money. And by that, I'll look at people who do takeout all the time. Now, not so much in Tucson. We're not really a takeout-driven economy. But in big cities, there are people that make significant incomes that don't keep food in their house. And literally, they've got a box of Kraft macaroni and cheese, it's unusual. So, you know, these kinds of things affect us all differently. But there's no question, as we said in 1998, 1999, and every year since then, you need to be able to take care of yourself and your family for, say, 3 days is like anything less than that is reckless. And then 14 days is what is the recommendation. And then, you know, a lot of people believe 30 days is the right amount of time to be able to take care of people. So let's look at what they're taking, what people are going out and buying. Again, it's lower brainstem. I mean, the very basics that you need in life, like bottled water, there's no indication that we're going to have a problem with the water supply. So I would go out and tell people, don't buy a bottle of water. But the truth is they ought to have bottled water, not for this problem, but for others. You know, the earthquake or the, yeah, right, exactly, yeah. Or the sudden contaminant that shows up in the
and
water
it depends
system.
On where you live too.
Sure. And so I don't want to discourage people from buying water, but that's not meeting the needs of this particular pandemic. I guess they're gonna, you know, load up on bottled water and then toilet paper. Well, again, that's lower brainstem. That's one of the functions that's going to continue regardless. I know a lot of people don't have a lot of space in their house to be able to store a lot of stuff. But being reasonable and making sure that you're able to take care of yourself for between 14 and 30 days is probably the appropriate standard for Americans. You know, people for a long time have maybe laughed about the preparations of other. I'll use the example of the Church of Jesus Christ and Latter-day Saints. I'm not a member of the church, so I feel as if I can speak, you know, objectively about this, but their whole social fabric is built around being able to take care of each other and through thick and thin. And so their self-reliance and their ability to take care of themselves means they're a real asset in disasters to other people in the community. And that's the joke that people say, and it's not a derogatory joke, it's actually quite complimentary, and that is, hey, I don't really need to prepare because I have a friend who's a member of the Church of Jesus Christ and Latter-day Saints, and I know that if it gets bad, they'll help us. And I've heard people say that jokingly, laugh, like, you know, they don't have to do it. But so there's, you know, there's a wide range of things you can do to prepare for this emergency and the emergencies that are sure to come. So,
oh, yeah. We need to be prepared to take care of our immediate family. And if everybody did that, we'd be not doing what we're doing now.
Yeah.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a few. Thanks for staying with us. Our guest today is John Lovett from TPD Counter-Narcotics. If you have any questions, the number is 790-2040. And we're talking about the run on the grocery stores and Costco. And what about these food buckets that they sell at both the big box stores?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's a bad idea to have one in the closet, I suppose. But I think the most important thing to remember is that those are for like the 25-year storage lifetime. So it's a good idea maybe to have something like that. But the truth is, in an emergency, you're going to want to eat food you normally eat. And the reason you're going to want to do that and supplies that you normally use. And the reason you're going to want to do that is because you rotate that so that it's always fresh. And if you buy stuff, like I think the big example I saw or was watching the other day on television was people buying huge bags of rice and pinto beans. And I think those are great foods. But if you don't eat them on a regular basis, throwing a bag of beans and a bag of rice is in your closet is probably not going to help you in a situation like this. Right, exactly. So what you should do is figure out what you normally eat and figure out a way to rotate that through what you have so you don't spend extra money and you don't waste money. You know, ultimately, you'll use it all anyway is the idea. And so I just think that those kits, again, they appeal to our lower brain stem because, well, someone smarter than me figured out how to keep me alive for a month. Yeah, some of that stuff is, I wouldn't call it particularly tasty, and I don't know that it would meet everyone's needs. Some of it's very good, but I mean, I'm just saying that it's, if you don't eat it every day, you probably ought to make sure you have stuff available that you would use every day.
Normal things, and first aid things as well.
Yeah, you know, you're not going to have a surgical kit. You're not going to be able to do heart surgery yourself, but you certainly ought to have the basics for wound care. You know, the worst thing that could happen to you right now, I'll give you the example, is that, you know, you're out there trimming your tree and you fall off your ladder and then you have to go to the emergency room or sit in an urgent care full of people coughing on you.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm not saying you should give up trimming the trees, but I'm saying that you should be very careful about what you do that might get you injured and land you in an emergency room. Just because, well, for two reasons. One, you don't want to contract anything. And the other is you don't want to take the resources away from the people who really need them.
I noticed when I lived in California, we lived on a fault line. Our preparedness was a lot different than what I prepare for here in Arizona. And I think people need to think about, where am I living? What can happen potentially? And how would I react to this? How would I get out of it or survive it? And plan accordingly.
Yeah, so the Red Cross has got some great resources about what to do in store. And recently they've added in, and you can buy this pack from us, but you don't have to buy the pack. It's important that you read about what it is they recommend you be able to have available to take care of yourself and your family. And, you know, again, if you do this all the time, then, like, I mean, my family, we've certainly been able to take care of ourselves, but I can tell you that when this came up, it wasn't something that caused the lower brainstem reaction for us, because it's an issue, but it's not going to be the issue that that we're not prepared for. I mean, could we get sick? Sure, we could get sick. And having a plan for that is really important, because there's some estimates that 2/3 of America will get sick at one point or another during this. And if that's true, You know, you have to decide who's going to take care of mom, who's going to make sure the kids get to school, or if there is school, you know, if the schools continue. You have to make those plans in advance. And if you make those plans in advance, then you're not surprised by something you might have to do that you haven't thought through.
It makes me think about when my son was little, we lived in a two-story place, and I got a ladder that he could hook on to the window and throw out the window in case there was an emergency, a fire or something. And I practiced with him, get on the ladder. I mean, he was 5, 6 years old. Get on the ladder and how to get out of the house and go to safety. And that was just something that we did.
Yeah,
and
sure.
And the neighbor thought I was nuts.
And they actually teach that in school. I mean, in the public schools and in the parochial schools in Tucson, they talk about that kind of thing. They have planning for, you know, what your your second grader is probably more prepared than you are for a disaster. And that they really do hammer it in at school, and they, you know, put together a plan, do what. You know, it's all hazards. Doesn't matter what the hazard is. Could be natural gas gets stopped. It could be that because of a pipeline explosion. It could be a pandemic. And I've always believed that a pandemic would be what would be of greatest significance to us. But we live in a very earthquake-prone region. There was a huge earthquake in the late 1800s here. Mm-hmm. And that's a blip in time in the geological history. So it could very well happen again. And so what would you do if that happened? I like to think that emergency services are able to handle everyone's problem, but time and time again, we're reminded that if you're not prepared, you take away resources that could be used for people who really need them. And so it's your responsibility as an American.
Yeah, stop hoarding.
Yeah, prepare, but don't hoard. Yeah,
exactly. So, okay, we beat that topic.
Yeah, we did.
I want to talk about what's going on with drugs and in the cartel, and you know, you're in the inside of this. Tell us what's going on.
Well, of course, we've over the last couple of years talked a lot on the show about drugs and the shifts that we've seen from time to time, and we introduced fentanyl actually to the Tucson community on your show, and the problems that we've had with that. So now the big trend is, as much as people want to snicker and laugh and make light of it, is the marijuana extracts. And I say that because we are seeing violence associated with it for sure in the sale and trafficking of marijuana extracts. We are seeing very serious health consequences to people, young people and old people, from vaping THC extracts. We have a Supreme Court decision that you know, the justices actually snickered and laughed about brownies and stuff during their deliberations on television. It was embarrassing. It was not a proud moment for the Arizona judiciary, and I hope they're listening. Because there are people who die from this. And it was very insensitive to see that kind of behavior from folks that are supposed to keep the public trust. And so in those cases, you know, the vaping issue is one where we all know that now it's in middle school for sure. People in middle school are vaping. Do their parents know about it? Absolutely not. That's part of the allure of vaping, is being able to do it and not have people know.
You're not smelling like tobacco.
Exactly.
You know, cigarette.
And they teach it. Go to online and, you know, look at ways to conceal the fact that you're vaping. And there's, you know, how to blow the vapor back into your sleeve on your shirt. And the trick now in high schools is to be able to vape in class while the teacher's teaching and not get caught. That's a trick that people get involved in. So, okay, vaping with flavors and tobacco products, nicotine products, they have their own risks. I acknowledge those are, you know, whatever you want to say about that. That's not my area. But I will say this. Once you get into the THC vape cartridges, it's very dangerous. And the issue really is how they're prepared. So Underwriters Laboratory doesn't have like a certification for a safe vape cartridge. But a lot of these are Wildcat produced. So they're produced by people who have no training, just like the fentanyl pills.
Okay, when you said Wildcat produced, I envisioned the kids at the U of A producing.
I mean more like Wildcat dumping. Yeah, no, right. They're produced by people who have no training, expertise, or anything. And so they get THC products from either California predominantly or Mexico, and then they fill these vape cartridges, and they make an enormous amount of money doing it, which is why they do it. And then they sell them for, say, $40 to $80 a piece, depending on how they're packaged and sold and all of that. And they can make millions off this. And so the issue really is, if you take the THC, there's no guideline for what the strength of it should be when it goes into these cartridges. So if you have a pound or, you know, a quart of butane hash oil, it's one of the things they use to do this, and you want to make that make twice as much money for you, you simply take it and add another quart or something else to it. And it's called cutting it, right? People are familiar with how that's happened with heroin and cocaine over the years, although in Tucson, almost all the drugs we have are pure, and so are close to pure. So what happens is they take that gallon or that quart of THC oil, they add a quart of, well, at the time it was like, well, vitamin E, I mean, everyone knows vitamin E is good for you, right? And so they get these vitamin E oils from these places that sell vitamins, and they'd mix them, the two of them. Well, it turns out vitamin E in your lungs is a lot like having lye in there. And so the little sacs at the end of your lungs get destroyed by this vitamin E oil. It's not, vitamin E oil, you know, look, just because it's a small amount of it is good as an, or could be good or have benefit pharmaceutically, or, you know, doesn't mean that taking it doesn't mean smoking it, setting it on fire and or heating it up and sucking it into your lungs is going to be a healthy activity. So you look at the spate of vaping related illnesses that occurred over the last year, and almost all of them, as I say, 95% of them are tracked back to THC vaping. The other 5% of the people are lying. I mean, because that's what it is. It's these our experiences. It's these vape cartridges. So that's the emerging threat for community safety, public safety here. But because the money is so good for this, moving it is one of the more dangerous narcotics trafficking operations there is.
Well, I know I have a friend who had no idea that her son was vaping and had been vaping for a couple of years. Is there anything that a parent can spot or be aware of that would help them, you know, help their kids not get in trouble like this and not use this THC?
Well, I mean, I think it's just a parenting question. And, I guess it depends about what your values are and how you raise your children. I don't blame parents for what's happening here, but I can say that if your children are, or young adults that are, or young people in high school, if they're active doing constructive activities, it's really hard for them to find the time to do the other stuff.
Keep them busy. Right. They can't get in trouble.
And don't be the cool mom or dad. I mean, that's really not your job.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, parent up and be a parent. And so, like, if your children are involved in music or sports or extracurricular activities, then they're much less likely to get involved in these other pursuits. And, you know, this trust but verify is really important. I'm not saying that you shouldn't trust your children, but I'm saying that you should know what it is they're up to. You should know who their friends are. And I know they hate that. You know, I used to joke with my kids and say, hey, why don't you introduce me to your new little friends when they were in high school, and they'd laugh. But it was like, they want you to be involved in what they're doing. And so many parents are pulled nine different ways. It's very hard for them. It's not, you know, and I know people who are parents who have single parents in particular who have to work 40 or 80 or, you know, the two or three jobs sometimes.
That was one.
Right, exactly. And it really is hard to raise your kids when you're working 80 hour a week and all of that. So, and I don't want to be real critical of the parents, but I think you, just like anything else they might get involved in, and you just got to be involved so that you know. And by the way, they do care about what you say. You do need to tell them they shouldn't be doing it. And things like, well, if you, a lot of parents say, well, I don't want to be a hypocrite. I smoked dope when I was in high school. Well, hopefully you're smarter now than you were when you were in high school.
Hopefully.
You know, hopefully you've evolved.
Brain developed.
Right. So share with them what you know now, and don't worry so much about what you did. I mean, because you were stupid doesn't mean your kids should be. And so... You know,
and my dad told me you're not allowed to do that, and I didn't do it.
Right.
My dad said no.
That really does matter that you say no and not to do it. So, I mean, those kind of trends are big. I mean, I think, you know, the drug treatment message is getting out there a little better now. It's still a little confused, though.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a few. Thanks for staying with us. Our guest today is John Lovett from TPD, Counter Narcotics, and we are talking about a myriad of topics. We're just covering everything. I want to talk about, we've talked about the drug situation and people getting involved with drugs. Let's talk about rehab.
Drug treatment, of course, the answer to the people who currently have substance use disorder. And, of course, our job is to, you know, do drug enforcement, drug education, and harm mitigation, things like that out of the Counter Narcotics Alliance. And so this is really an important spoke in the wheel here. We want to keep as many people off or out of having a drug problem through education. We want to get the people who do have it into treatment, and we want to take the people who profit off it and put them in prison. We're pretty good at putting people in prison, and we're going to continue that. We don't take our foot off the floor when it comes to that. That's one of the reasons we don't have the levels of public corruption here that they do in so many other big cities that have drug trafficking issues. But the education programs are certainly out there. People have heard more about these drugs in the last couple of years than they ever have, I think. And I think the last part is the treatment. And part of the education component is to make sure people knew that it's effective, available, and affordable. And when I say that, and that's one of the things I say whenever I speak in the community, people, especially people my age, say, you know, older, say 50 to 60 to 70, they're not used to knowing that drug treatment's available. And they, we need a grant to be able to pay for it. No, we don't. I mean, all of that's been taken care of. The infrastructure is there. It's simply getting the clients to show up now. That's the issue.
And their willingness to take part in it.
Exactly. They got to be ready for it, for sure. I mean, I certainly learned that in the last couple of years, I've learned a great deal. But I think the other thing is we look back on what we know of for drug treatment, and we say, well, it has to be inpatient, 28-day program. It has to be this or it has to be that. Well, I'm not a professional in the treatment arena, and you do mortgages.
I do mortgages.
Right, and I do law enforcement, and we know a little bit about these things, but I'm not ready to land jets on an aircraft carrier because I watch Top Gun, and I don't think I should be making a call about what the appropriate treatment is for people. And here's the example I'll use. Most people think it's inpatient or it's worthless, and the truth is my experience has shown me that the vast majority of successful candidates go through an outpatient program because they're in the, and at least my assessment, it's maybe not, maybe it's not valid, but it's certainly what I've seen, is that it puts them in a situation where they're in real life recovering as opposed to isolating them. And here's the deal. I'm sure inpatient treatment's necessary for certain people under certain circumstances, but the vast majority of the treatment that I've seen is outpatient. And so when someone goes into treatment, there may be a period of detoxification, and then after that, they go in an outpatient. The people who are not familiar with modern treatment approaches through medicine-assisted treatment, they see they only kept them 3 days, and they kicked them out the door, and the treatment's over. Well, no, that's not true. The treatment's not over. The real secret is, what do they do over the next 3 to 5 years? And they've got some excellent programs where people are engaging almost every day, if not every day, with their treatment provider as part of their getting back to a normal life, and they're very effective programs. And so I think it's our lack of understanding of what medicine-assisted treatment is and can do is what has caused us to not push people towards treatment who maybe are skeptical.
And I think if we get more people, our friends, our family, or whoever we know, our neighbor, into a treatment program, we would have less demand for the cartels to be delivering what they deliver.
Yeah, you know, it's the process of trying to deal with this problem involves keeping new people from getting in the door, helping those people that are in the system right now, and holding those responsible who facilitate all this. And those are the three parts, and that's what we're doing. We're involved in all three parts. I recently wrote an op-ed that ended up published in the Arizona Daily Star regarding this constant refrain that we're doing nothing in law enforcement to help people get into treatment. Wow. And clearly these people that are talking about that don't know what they're talking about.
Exactly.
I do a meeting a day or several meetings a week with treatment providing groups and people like that. And we're plugged in. We're the chairman of some of these. We're the chair people in some of these organizations. And we do nothing but try to get people into treatment and make it successful. And so I asked a group of probably 40 people in the Community Prevention Coalition a couple weeks ago at a meeting. I said, "What? So Why is it everybody thinks that law enforcement's not involved in this? Why do they think that suddenly we're not woke? I mean, I get so irritated in watching people say, we need to do something to stop people putting people who are using drugs in prison. Well, no kidding. Welcome to the effort. We've been doing this for a long time. And I appreciate that suddenly you're woke, but you really need to understand a lot of us have been busting our butts for a long period of time trying to get this accomplished. And we've made tremendous progress. And the fact that you just pulled your head out of the newspaper or wherever it was to be able to recognize it, to recognize that, well, good for you. I mean, welcome to the party. Why don't you join us? Because that's what we're doing. So it's really insulting when you see people say these things. And there was another op-ed that responded to my op-ed that said essentially, well, you really shouldn't put dealers in prison because putting dealers, these dealers are all, you know, they're trying to help their friends and they're providing them medicine because they're sick. And no, they're not. There's two groups of people involved in drugs. There's users and then there's dealers. They're not savers. People don't have 8 grams of heroin because they're saving up like a chipmunk, you know, for later. It's they use it if they're users and they sell it if they're dealers.
Yeah.
And so those people that are on the streets and everywhere else selling these drugs and making a profit from it, they need to go to prison, and that's the only answer. It's not because we're going to lock up everyone who's doing it. It's because I want people to know that if they engage in dealing this poison that's killing people, I want them to know that they have a substantial risk of losing everything they have and going to prison and having their liberty taken from them because they're taking the lives of these people, and if they're not killing them, they're ruining their lives, and they're ruining their kids' lives, and they're ruining their parents' lives. So we're really really keen on enforcement, but we're there for all the treatment and all the other activities that are involved in this continuum.
And if they sell something or give somebody something and it does kill them, they can be held accountable for that too.
So we've had a whole series of cases that are lined up. Well, we started prosecuting these 2 or 3 years ago. There's a case from October of 2017 where Judge Rainer Collins in the federal court gave the woman involved in a 10-year prison sentence for providing drugs to someone who died from an overdose. And it's a little more complicated than that, but we you know had another one where we had a plea agreement this last week for the Halloween party that the girl, the woman that brought drugs, she's now taken a plea that's like, I don't know if it's 12 to 22 years in federal court for killing one person and poisoning others and juveniles. Yeah. And so, and we've got, you know, other cases that are now coming forward that have been waiting in the sidelines to see what kind of sentences they're getting out of these trends. And so here's the good news. The good news is we've turned the corner. People in Southern Arizona understand grand juries want to indict people for manslaughter or for negligent homicide on these cases. They want to do that. The rest of the state is way behind us. The prosecutorial agencies don't have maybe the vision that we do locally in trying to go after these dealers. So that's why when I see that you know, people say all the time about how, oh, the prosecutors here are only after people, you know, for simple possession. That's not true.
It's not true.
And, you know, in addition to everything else that we do, on Wednesdays I go to a meeting, and maybe there's a listener or two out there that is at that same meeting, where we go through the entire jail population, and then we take a look at who's there on simple possession charges, and we try to find ways to get them out of jail and into treatment, okay? So it's like everything that everyone thinks is a brand new idea about how to deal with this. Thank you. Join our cause. Help us. We're already doing it.
For decades.
Yeah. And we'd appreciate your help. And as opposed to you going out and demeaning the good work of all of these social workers and frankly, police officers and court officials, all these people who've been doing this for years. So welcome aboard. More the merrier. We'd love to have you on our side.
Absolutely. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back in a few. Okay, thanks for staying with us. Our guest is John Levitt from TPD Counter Narcotics. And before we start talking about other stuff, I want to make an announcement. Law Matters was going to be hosting a cybersecurity event on the 24th of April, and that has been postponed until after this madness is over with. And it's going to be a great event when it does happen. I'll keep you posted. But we also have something else going on. You don't even have to leave your house. Law Matters is hosting a GoFundMe effort because, and I don't know, John, if you know much about what happened, one of our canines became ill, and TPD was taking care of him financially and medically. And after this dog was released to go back to work, caught a bad guy. The bad guy turned around and bit the dog, took a chunk out of the dog, and medical bills have reached 15K. And the dog's getting better, dog's on the mend, but part of the cost of the medical bills came out of their fund to buy bite suits. Now, the bite suits that they're using are over 12 years old, and just like bulletproof vests, they have a life expectancy. You have to replace them. These are way beyond their life expectancy. They're torn, they've got holes. So because Law Matters is a nonprofit, we're a 501c3, we're doing a GoFundMe account to buy a couple of bite suits for TPD canine unit. These suits are expensive. They're like $2,000 a piece. So we're asking the community to go to lawmatters1030.org. That's our website. And if you hit the logo at the top left part of the page that you'll come to, it'll open up this GoFundMe account and you can donate. And anything you can give would, I'm not supposed to say donate on this show, support us. Anything you can do would be a huge benefit and help our guys so they can keep training. And training is essential, as you know. I don't care what department you're in the police department, training is essential.
Especially in the dog units. These are not machines. It's not like motorcycles or airplanes. Dogs are living, breathing, I won't say human beings, but they're dog beings, and they're
essential.
Yeah, absolutely essential to what we do. They make it a lot safer for officers and the public. And realistic training is really the key to having a successful canine unit. Our dog officers typically train about 25% of their time at work. So you figure a quarter of their time spent training. And a lot of it doesn't involve the bite suit, but that's certainly a significant portion of it. The problem with having old bite suits is you get injuries to the people that are wearing them if the dogs will bite. Essentially, they lose their effectiveness and their ability to protect the other half of the training team. And so live bite training is really important because it allows us to learn or to really reinforce getting out of a bite and doing it safely and not hurting people any more than is necessary. A dog bite's not pleasant for anyone, but it's true. And we don't want the officers getting bit either through the bite suit and getting hurt. The pressure that a dog exerts on a bite, independent of the dog teeth, is enough to break bones sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And so these bite suits are really a critical part of that. And so the fact that we don't have unlimited funds means they got to ration what they do. The dogs need medical care. It's pretty expensive over the course of a year. They have all these needs in that unit. And sometimes in tight budget times, there just isn't enough money to do everything. And so this approach that you're taking to assist them is really admirable. There's still some people that don't understand what a great life police canines have.
No, if I get reincarnated, I want to be
one. it's the person you know that's doing the job they really love. And no one's dogs, except, I guess some of us have dogs that we really pay attention to, but no one's dog gets to go with their person to work every day and be an integral part of the process. And they are the most spoiled sometimes and hardworking at other times and most of the times animals on the planet. And anything we can do to support them would be a good thing.
I've lived next door, actually, across the street from a canine officer, and that dog knew when he was at home. He was a puppy. But when that uniform went on and they got to the car, he was on duty. You didn't mess with that dog. And it was so fun to watch this change in that dog's personality because I'm at work now. And it was just something I just really admire the canine guys because most of them have families and the dogs are part of their family. They know how to, behave at home. And when they go to work, they're a whole different animal.
It's funny. We maintain a dog out at Trigger, out at Counter Narcotics Alliance. Mm-hmm. We've talked about Trigger before. And he's a chocolate lab, and he does drug detection. And he doesn't do any kind of of patrol assistance. It's simply about detecting drugs. And so I asked a manufacturer lately, they wanted to sell us a $500,000 machine about the size of a suitcase to determine whether or not something had drugs in it. And it's a very complicated machine. It's a wonderful thing. We don't really have the money for it right now, but a lot of agencies are buying those. And I asked the guy finally, I said, so how much better is this than what our canine can do? And the guy looked at me and says, well, this will be almost as good as what your canine can do.
Yeah.
So, and that's the guy who's selling this product. I mean, he's realistic, and the dogs just do super work.
And their training is consistently, they're constantly training.
Constantly. And it's everything that they do is training. And so, you know, really supporting working dogs is an admirable thing for us to do, but we get a huge benefit as a community from it.
Oh, absolutely. They're keeping us safe. And they're trained for different things. They're not just, you know, they're not all drug dogs. They're trained for different...
Bomb dogs. I mean, dogs that do detection for bombs. Whenever we have a big event with a lot of people, they'll sweep the whole area with bomb dogs. Military helps us with that as well. But it's like those dogs sniff for the odors of things that will hurt us all.
Yeah.
And don't you want those out there? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
So, exactly.
So, okay. I want everybody to listen up. lawmatters1030.org. If you go there, in the upper left-hand corner, there's a logo for Law Matters. Click on that, and it'll take you to the page where the GoFundMe account is, and you can help us out. You can help our officers out, because they're out there keeping us safe, and we want to keep them safe, too. This is what we can do to give back. So, and I won't stop harping about it. Until we've reached our goal, because these I saw some of the bruises, and I'm like, oh my God, there's holes in their outfits. So I want to talk a little bit about the Y2K. We hit on it a little bit when we started. Want people to put things in perspective. Things are going to happen. We're always going to have some kind of a flu or a virus going around. Always going to have some type of a, oh my God, it's the end of the world. So what can people do to just keep their head on their shoulders?
So it's really a difficult thing to talk about, because if you're in that prime time age group of say 60 and older, and you have any of the underlying conditions, you probably ought to really limit what you do outside of your house. And I say that with some trepidation, because I know there are so many people who depend upon being waiters and busboys and waitresses and businesses that are going to suffer because for a month or so, there'll be very limited activity.
Yeah.
All I can say is, like, if you have tickets, we have tickets to Broadway in Tucson, and we may not go to the event this week because of the crowd. And I think it would be...
Do you have a hazmat suit you can go?
Well, it's exactly. But I think... But some people go, well, we'll get that money back. No, we won't. We support community theater, and we support Broadway in Tucson, and there's no reason to do that. So try to do what you do, being cognizant of there are people who are at much greater risk than you are likely, and
yes.
Try to think about the situation that they're in, and try to do what you can to follow the rules and not be that guy. Specifically, if you think you have symptoms, call your doctor. Don't just show up in an emergency room. Don't go in and infect everybody if you're sick, and get infected.
It's so easy now. You can just do FaceTime with a doctor. A lot of your insurance companies have a 24-hour call in, and here are my symptoms. What do you think? You can get help without infecting everybody.
And don't demand a test. I mean, think about it for a second. If you have it, you do. If you don't, you don't.
Yes.
In any case, you're sick. And if
not
you're sick,
a guessing game.
Do what you can to take care of yourself. Follow the directions the doctor gives. If you demand a test because you somehow deserve it, and you deny the ability for those to be appropriately administered in circumstances where they're indicated, that's not very American. I mean, that's pretty selfish. That's not the kind of thing we'd expect.
Okay. What about, and I don't know if you've heard, I know I have not heard anything. What about babies? I know we've talked about the elderly. They need to be, you know, because they have other symptoms. What about babies?
That's a good question for the health director. I mean, I public health people, I don't know. I haven't heard a lot of cases, but again, we're only hearing about the cases that are, you know, on the news, if
horrible.
You will.
Yeah.
And so I don't know about babies, but I know this. I mean, there's still other pathogens out there that you need to worry about. So I think just following good common sense regulations. I don't want to use the wash your hands reference. I've heard it at least 58,000 times in the last week. But that's all true. I mean, practicing good hygiene is always a good idea, regardless of the pandemic that faces us or doesn't.
Exactly.
Right? You know, take a shower, wash your hands, do the things your mom told you to, and you'll probably be in better shape than if you don't.
You'll be okay. Okay. Well, I want to, we've only got a few minutes left. I want to ask everybody, please go to lawmatters1030.org, and on there, that's our website. And actually, there's podcasts on there from shows gone by, and there's photographs. The event page is blank because we had to postpone our event for the 24th of April. And we'll be doing that. It's going to be a good event. It's about cybersecurity. Everybody's got this on their mind because of the new hacks and everything that are coming into our computers, but also because of the election. We've got the military coming in. They'll be telling us what's going on and keeping us up to date on the latest and greatest. And they might even talk about the pandemic. You don't know. But if there's anything you can do to help our canine unit, donate or support. I'm sorry, support. And we'll see if we can help these people. John, what's your parting words of advice for everybody?
Well, I think we just need to pull together. We need to work towards the future. I'm not into the blame storming of how we got to where we're at. It doesn't really matter. And
It is what it is.
Yeah, we're here. So let's go forward and let's do what we can to take care of each other and make sure that we're not being that guy and pigs about it, and really help your neighbors out. Do what you can to help each other, and we'll get through this. And a year from now, we'll be hopefully out the other end and have an idea of being able to look back.
So use common sense and absolutely check on your neighbor. I know I've got an elderly neighbor that I check on periodically. I take cookies over there and stuff over there just to check on her. She thinks I'm feeding her. I'm checking on her. I want to make sure she's there and she's okay.
It's a difficult time for everyone. Also, be a little more patient with people in the parking lot. You know, try to not use your middle finger as much as you might when you get angry at people in traffic.
I can't do that anymore?
No, it's not a good idea.
Okay, I will try to be patient. And like we said, don't go to the doctor. Don't go to the emergency room if you're sick.
Call first.
Yeah. If you're having a heart attack, it's a different story.
Exactly. leave those resources for the people who are having the heart attack.
Exactly. So I want to thank everybody for joining us this morning. I want to thank you, John, for getting up early and coming over here and talking common sense that everybody needs to hear once in a while and not panic about what's going on, because we will live through this. And until next week, I want everybody to shop local, stay safe. And next week, we're going to have former Congressman Jim Colby on, and we're going to talk about politics a little bit. Not a lot, because we're not a political show, but we're going to talk about it. And, the scams for the coronavirus. Are there scams going on?
Oh, I'm sure there are.
You've got 30 seconds.
Anytime people have the opportunity to exploit others, they try. So we just, again, need to watch out for those.
So use your head. Your future depends on it.
Yep.
See you next week.